My name is Arianis, and I am the Senior Multifaith Educator at Global Spiritual Life at New York University, and you are listening to Multifaithful, the podcast about religious diversity, multifaith dialogue, and effing the ineffable. On this week's podcast, I am joined by Dr. Joy Layden, Professor of English at Stern College for Women at Yeshiva University. We discuss what it's like to be the first transgender professor within the Yeshiva University system, being a published poet, and how women's colleges across the United States can design a policy that is inclusive of different forms of women's gender identity. Thank you for listening to Multifaithful, and now onto this week's episode. I am joined today by Dr. Joy Layden, the Gottesman Professor at Yeshiva University, and her seventh book of poetry, Impersonation, is out recently. We're going to talk to her a little bit more about her poetry in a few minutes. And joining us as a student is Hannah Leffingwell, who has been on this podcast before. But Hannah, can you introduce yourself again, just for those people who maybe haven't listened to every episode?
Sure. I'm Hannah. I'm a master's student in the French Studies program at NYU, and I just started here a couple months ago in the Global Spiritual Life office. So I'm really excited to be here.
So, Professor Layden, you are the first poet we've had on this podcast. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about some of the topics that you write about most frequently, or some of the topics that you find most rich to explore.
Well, I started writing poetry when I was six. So there have been a lot of different topics. In my latest book, it's unusual in that it starts with, it includes poems that I started toward the end of my life living as a man, and the early poems at the beginning of gender transition, and then some that were written more recently. So a lot of it is about identity and the gender identity. There's also a lot of stuff about Jewish identity. One of the, I guess my way of being openly a minority before I came out as trans was through expressing Jewish identity, which already felt like a risk in American poetry. There are a lot of American poets who are Jews, but poetry that's really rooted in Jewish identity, Jewish texts, that is something that I always felt, I think correctly, would be unintelligible to a lot of readers of American poetry.
And would that be true even of Jewish texts like the Old Testament, or texts that are even very familiar to like a Christian audience also?
Yes and no. So if you write about things as the Old Testament, as opposed to the Torah, then it's more familiar.
Right.
The closer you get to writing about it as the Torah, the less familiar it gets.
That so makes sense.
The closer you are to what I think of as Sunday school versions of biblical stories, which is to say, stories that are very determinate, they have morals, the characters are really clear-cut, they have beginnings and ends, in other words, they don't resemble the Torah at all.
Right.
Those are the most intelligible. And American poetry has a skeptical bias, which often translates into a secular bias. Mm-hmm. So poems that are snarky about God, those I think travel pretty well. But it's quite hard to write poems from a position of relationship with God or belief in God that are taken seriously as poetry. Publishing an essay that's about the history of how that happened, I took it for granted. I just sort of grew up with that.
Right.
But it's odd when you think about it. And it does have to do with the history of American poetry. I don't think it's the case in other languages.
Yeah, it strikes me as being somewhat parallel to the university history of higher education, as being less interested in religious identity than some other forms of identity. And in a lot of ways, what we're doing at NYU is later to the university setting, because I think this has only come into a lot of people's consciousness recently, and I think it was ignored for a long time.
Yes.
Now that we're talking kind of about university issues, I saw actually on your biography that you went to UMass Amherst for your MFA.
Yes.
And I graduated from Mount Holyoke College.
Oh.
So, yeah. So I actually wanted to ask you about the value of a women's education, because you teach at a women's college, correct? Yeah. So I know with a lot of women's colleges lately, a topic has been how inclusive that environment is to other identities. So Mount Holyoke College, for example, changed their policy recently to include trans applicants, and that includes male to female as well as female to male. And other women's colleges have different policies. But I was just wondering if you could speak to the value of this idea of a women-centered space, especially when it comes to different queer identities within that space.
Easy question.
You can see why we bring her for interviews.
I spoke at Mount Holyoke in the spring, actually, about the politics of trans identities at women's colleges. But I'd like to start with the more familiar ground, which is I really value women's colleges and women's education. I find, you know, we live in a society which is largely homosocial. That, you know, whether the gender binary should be seen as evil or good or neutral, it doesn't matter, to the extent that it almost everything in almost every place is structured strongly in terms of gender and gender relationships. Not as strongly as in the Orthodox Jewish world, in secular spaces, but gender roles and mores and relationships have a tremendous impact even in secular spaces. And in those spaces, most friendships and organizations are still homosocial. They are. So I noticed, it's been a long time now that I've been at Stern, but before that I taught in secular mixed sections, and it was quite hard to get women to talk when there were more than a few men in a class. And it was very hard to get men to talk when there were a certain critical mass of women. So it was clear that gender dynamics were playing an important and not apparently constructive, or maybe that was my limitations as a teacher at that time. You know, you got to work with what you have, and I couldn't figure out how to make something positive out of that. It just seemed like an obstacle that I was working against. When I came to Stern, I'd not known Orthodox people, so my stereotype was, well, these, you know, poor, benighted children of a misogynist, patriarchal society. Fortunately for them, I'm coming from the secular world to deliver them, and I was really surprised to find all of these smart, articulate women who took their lives, they'd been raised to take their lives really seriously, because that's one of the things about halakha. You can look at it as obsessive compulsive disorder, or you can look back at it as a way of saying pretty much everybody's life matters, because we all have roles to perform that matter to God. Even if you're somebody who's marginalized, you don't matter to other people. Your actions do matter to God.
And just for listeners who are unaware, halakha refers to the kind of details of Jewish law and Jewish observance that are done in the Orthodox world most commonly.
Yes. So in secular settings, I found it was actually hard for students to have a sense that their lives had meaning. You know, this is the problem with a secular world in which there is no guarantor of meaning. You have to make it up yourself, which is extremely difficult. It's hard for most individuals to generate a whole value system that gives meaning to their lives. It's challenged constantly. And suddenly I found myself teaching in a place where students had mostly grown up in a universe that was God-centered, in which the value of their lives was guaranteed. And I also hadn't realized that if you are in a homosocial setting, the effects of, definitely there's misogyny and all kinds of stuff, but if there aren't men around, then it doesn't play that much of a role. And I would imagine at the men's college, when there aren't women around, whatever that stuff is, it doesn't come into play that much, because it's only a factor when those things are combined. So it's weird to me that students who know 16 times as much as I do about Judaism don't count for a minion. It would always startle me. So that would be a case where I could see the problematic, from my perspective, aspects of Orthodox Judaism. But mostly what I saw was that there were a lot of advantages of women who had grown up in a homosocial space where their immediate influences and authorities and role models were women. That was taken for granted. It's starting to not sound so bad, right? It's starting to sound like a lesbian separatist paradise.
Mm-hmm.
not that that was the way they saw it. But if you go back to the 70s, that's what it starts to sound like, right? Women getting a sense of what women are from other women, and right? So when they are looking to traditional texts and rabbinic texts, that's not a great mirror to look at.
Right.
In a homosocial world, the proximate authorities, the people who are setting values, the people you're working with, these are all, you know, women working with women. And so they, to me, that seemed to be really good for a lot of the women in there. Now, the women who did not fit into the culture for one reason or another had difficulties. And there are a lot of reasons that people don't fit into Orthodox culture or other actual normative communities and cultures. We use the word community very loosely in America.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly
mm-hmm.
people aren't in communities, but in the Orthodox world, there are actual communities which have actual norms, and there are pluses and minuses to that. So families where one parent, for example, converted to Judaism, those students often had grown up feeling marginalized to some extent from their communities, or where there were disabilities in the family. There are a number of reasons that people, this also surprised me, could feel marginalized within the Orthodox world. There are also students at Stern who are moving away from Orthodoxy,
mm-hmm.
or they're moving toward more observant Orthodoxy than is the norm at Stern. So it wasn't that everybody was the same, which surprised me. It wasn't that everybody felt that they fit in. The more on the outside of that culture you felt, I think the harder it tends to be for students. But the dynamics of a women's college seemed to me great. Of course, you know, I've now committed the sin of saying something good about the gender binary.
It seems difficult to avoid that sometimes.
Well, it is. It's one of the paradoxes of feminism.
It really is.
You know, you criticize binary gender, but also valorize
mm-hmm.
the aspects of it that are around women's identity.
Mm-hmm.
So you asked me about what happens at women's colleges with, you said queer identities, but I think you were really thinking about trans identities.
Yeah,
non-binary.
Specifically, right.
So those are tough. And I thought I did a close reading at the end of my talk at Mount Holyoke of their admissions policy.
Mm-hmm.
And it has, on one side, the people that they'll admit, there's a very complicated set of criteria,
mm-hmm.
you have identified or whatever, right? The other side is just anybody who was born and identifies as male. So in one way, it looks like, whoa, the gender binary, what's happened to it? It's mutated. And on the other side, it's like, no, it's the same world.
Yep.
There are guys, and then there are non-guys.
Exactly.
And non-guys can be very different and diverse, but, right,
mm.
that's
mm-hmm.
not unfamiliar. It's paralleled by the changes in the range of gender expression. So on the guy side,
right.
gender expression is very narrow. When
mm-hmm.
privilege is conferred based on a certain characteristic, you need to make sure that you can identify the people who can hold that privilege. So
mm-hmm.
often, that's the price you pay for privilege, is a constrained range of individual expression.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not surprising that women were able to win a vastly increased range of gender expression.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not despite the fact that they have less privilege, but I think because they have less privilege, there was
right.
less at stake. So I think that that's interesting. One of the things that I said was, I think there's a kind of gender diversity that's important that is not being talked about, and that has to do with this paradox of feminism, of criticizing the gender binary and valuing like the women's side of the gender
mm-hmm.
binary. It doesn't make too much sense.
Mm-hmm.
Is that there are actually multiple ideas about gender, that form of diversity. So people with really non-binary gender identities have not just different gender identities, but different theories of gender. The theory
mm-hmm.
of gender is that it's not an intersubjective, shared, socially determined category. All of that requires conventions and standardization
mm-hmm.
and you have to use the same language, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what a standard
right.
identity means. It defines gender as individual self-expression that is based on how people feel and
mm-hmm.
can fluctuate depending on how people feel. The important thing is being true to yourself. So it's a form of radical individualism.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really different idea of gender than people who see gender as established sets of categories, however you configure them, that are mutually intelligible and that have certain kinds of conventions. So what women's colleges are doing is, that I don't think they're talking enough about, is admitting people with very different ideas about what gender is. And that's a form of gender diversity that's important and that we're just starting to reckon with, but if we can't talk about it, if it's so politicized that you can't even admit that there are these variations,
mm-hmm.
I think that's a problem. So the metaphor that I was offering was a religious diversity. So here in this office, I think you have religious people who literally live in different worldviews, right? So if you live in a world where history changed when Jesus was born and died, that's different than if you live in the world of an Orthodox Jew.
Mm-hmm.
That whatever those events were, they did not actually change the nature of history or the human relationship with God. And after, you know, many centuries of bloodshed, some of us have figured out how to say, right, you live in this version of human history and actually ontology, the
mm-hmm.
idea of human relationship with God, what God is really different than mine, and I actually can tolerate the fact that you're sitting there having these incommensurate beliefs. My beliefs don't fit with yours at all. There's no bridge here, and it's still okay. I can still exist. I don't have to kill you until you believe what I say. We don't have to reconcile this and come up with something else. We can actually live in a world that has these incommensurate visions of what reality and God are. So compared to those kinds of differences, I think differences in theories of gender ought to be small potatoes. But we haven't yet, I think, started acknowledging those differences and talking about them and learning what it means to sit in the same room with them.
Mm-hmm.
So on the note of kind of thinking about religious people sitting with each other and encountering difference, I'm curious, I know most of the conversations that you do and the interviews you do focus on the experience of being trans in deeply rooted in the Jewish world. And I'm curious whether you have found a sort of like common fellowship or friendship with some people who maybe also are very involved in a traditional
mm-hmm.
Jewish world, whether it's Muslim, Christian, Hindu, whatever it is, Sikh, and are also trans, and whether you found those experiences to be similar or they're really not, and kind of the experiences are just very different depending on what community you come from.
I have not known a lot of trans people who are rooted in different faith traditions. Not none, but not a lot. But I have found that in some ways the secular religious divide is a greater divide than the trans and non-trans divide. Like in queer people who are religious often feel pretty lonely in a
mm-hmm.
queer world that tends to be, you know, take it for to see queer identity as secular, which is also part of what the problem is with inclusion of queer people in religious settings. If religious traditions tend to see queer identity also as a secular product of individualism, which is therefore
mm-hmm.
something you can't integrate, because an individualistic construction of identity is antithetical to most traditional religions. So there's this weird sort of agreement between a lot of faith communities and a lot of secular queer settings that you shouldn't be able to be queer and religious.
Right.
Things shouldn't go together. So I often feel like right at home with anybody who's religious.
Yeah.
There's a commonality. One of the people who I've met who's, I would say, because of the different travels I've done, I've met people who really are heroes. And
mm-hmm.
one of the most inspiring was this. I was doing a Torah reading workshop at the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force convention. They have a religion and spirituality section, so we were this
mm-hmm.
little subset.
Mm-hmm.
Else was doing politics, we were doing these other things. So
it's like the higher education meetings, like the 10 people who do religion and everyone else is talking about politics. People in it are great, though.
Right, and you get very close to them, right?
Yeah.
So we had a lot of people were Jewish, but some people weren't Jewish. And one of the people was this small blonde woman, introduced herself, and she said she was a fundamentalist Christian. She received Christ into her life a few years before. She'd been a social worker in Buffalo, and she and her husband now lived in rural Idaho. And everybody is like, okay, you're the diversity in the room. And what the heck are you doing here?
Mm.
So she said, you know, she would be in these towns in Idaho and she would notice these really strange looking kids hanging around on the street. And they were teenagers. They were too young to go into bars. And they were getting beaten up all the time. Nobody would have anything to do with them. She couldn't make head or tail of them. So she started talking to them. She said, both as a social worker, but also as a Christian. She thought
mm-hmm.
that this is, you know, you see people who are outcasts and who are needy,
right.
you need to make contact with them and see if you can help. So she found out that they were trans kids in rural Idaho, a terrible place to be a trans kid.
Mm-hmm.
So she started working with them and advocating for them. And she said, you know, and now I don't understand how this is. I'm doing this because I'm following Jesus, but it's making it impossible for me to go to church
mm-hmm.
because I can't sit there listening to people say horrible things about my kids. And so I've come here so I can learn more about who they are and how I can help them. So she paid her own way
wow.
from Idaho all the way here to be the only straight evangelical Christian, probably in two hotels full of queer people.
Wow.
Because she was called to do that, and in doing that, she felt like she'd become an outcast from her own faith community.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like that, to me, is the model of a truly religious person.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty remarkable story.
Wow. It's hard to follow on that.
It is hard to follow
on
that.
I guess one thing I wanted to ask you about, which I think maybe relates to this a little bit, when you're talking about trans kids and being young and having the experience of being any kind of marginalized identity, really, and having to try and find solidarity somewhere in order to survive whatever it is you have to go through in your community. So I wanted to ask you about the power of writing as a tool for survival, reading as a tool for survival as well. I know for me and my experience coming out, there were certain authors that really were a profound anchor for me going through that. And I think that's true for many, many queer people and many trans people. So as a writer, how do you feel, what do you feel your purpose is speaking to those kids out there who maybe don't have anybody to talk to?
I think that's a great question. I'm not sure how much of my even sure how much I have a readership, but of that readership, I'm not sure how many would qualify as kids.
Mm.
I mean, some of this is practical. My, you know, my book is a university press book, and it has Jewish in it, and I think most trans people won't read it. You know, either
mm-hmm.
they're not Jewish or they're not religious, and they can't imagine this being relevant to them. But I have not mostly seen myself as writing for younger people. I've been really impressed by the tremendous growth in the amount of things that are written with teenagers and even younger kids, but I'm particularly thinking about the books about trans and queer teens and for trans and queer teens and the efforts that are, I just read a really dreadful young adult novel that was about somebody with what seemed to me to be a fairly preposterous identity, but that's like incredible progress when you can have bad novels. It's so common that this is happening.
That's so true.
That, you know, people think they can make money writing
that's
about
true.
Characters
yeah.
like this. This is great,
mm-hmm.
right? So,
yeah.
So I think that that's great. I think that one of the horrible things is that there's a crisis of abuse and homelessness among queer youth, trans youth in particular, but queer youth, it's this wholly disproportional part mm-hmm. of the homeless youth population, which is already a terrible thing, and the existing, the mainstream resources are often not safe for queer kids, particularly not for trans kids, and a lot of the gay and lesbian community's resources, that's where most of the resources are, have been focused on the marriage stuff.
Right.
And so mm-hmm. funding has been cut for youth shelters, mm-hmm. and it's exacerbated an already horrific situation. So for the kids who can't stay at home and they can't stay in school, I think many of them don't have a lot of the skills of reading and writing that would be tremendously mm-hmm. helpful for them. So mm-hmm. you asked, like,
right.
are these valuable? Absolutely. But I think that if you've been bullied at school and you've had to leave early,
mm-hmm.
there are excellent chances that those are not your strong suits.
Mm-hmm.
And
makes sense.
That a lot of the stuff that could be really helpful for you, you're not going to have access to without a lot of help.
Mm-hmm.
So if you could finish off the podcast with a book recommendation, what's the best book you've read in the last 6 months?
It's always a hard question.
When I'm interviewing student workers, I always end the interview with this question because I'm always looking for good books to read. So I figure if we got really smart students coming through my office, I might as well just ask them for ideas. So I'm pulling a page out of that playbook.
Okay. Well, what books have I read and finished in the last? I've been, most of my reading has been utilitarian and focused on stuff for classes and research that I've been doing. But the transgender studies readers that were edited by Susan Stryker, I can't remember the name of her co-editor, those are phenomenal. Susan is not single-handedly, but close, just sort of creating an intellectual history and an academic structure for mm-hmm. trans studies. She's single-handedly, I think, responsible for a lot of the very few tenure track positions in trans studies that are around the country. And these readers not only cull a lot of the most important and best writing, but they put them into conversation with one another and into historical perspective. And one of the problems with trans studies, and I think thinking about trans identity, and actually kids who may not have strong reading skills often still have access to the internet, and that's where a lot of learning about who we are comes
mm-hmm.
from.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the problem with that is that there's kind of a Tower of Babel situation with particularly trans identities. The terminology keeps changing.
Right.
Terms keep multiplying.
Mm-hmm.
It's very important for people to have names for themselves,
mm-hmm.
but if those names are not understood by other people, I think there's a lot of rage among trans people, like, I'm telling you who I am, I'm showing you who I am, what do you mean you don't understand what blah 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 means, but this isn't settled, it's not even settled in the trans world, much less
mm-hmm.
outside the trans world, so having these kinds of collections is creating the possibility for people to step back and say, wow, there's been this incredibly compressed evolution of thinking about gender and terms for gender, and what can we make of it when we try to look at it as a whole, as opposed to in these, pieces that don't seem to even be using the same vocabulary. So I recommend that.
Amazing. That's a great recommendation. We'll have to get on reading that. And thank you so much for your time, and good luck with the event tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Multifaithful. Special thank you to Dr. Joy Layden for appearing on the podcast and for sharing her wisdom with us. Special thank you to Hannah from our office for joining me on the interview, and to Brian Young for doing all things related to the podcast, as usual. Special thank you to Liz Suatos for the music from the Of Many film. Finally, if you have any questions, comments, suggestions about the podcast, please be in touch at spiritual.life@nyu.edu. We love to get feedback. Please rate and review us on iTunes. My mom loves those 5-star reviews. I mentioned this before, but I'm going to mention it again, so please give us a 5-star review to make my mother happy. Thanks for listening to another episode. Join us again next week for a new episode of Multifaithful.